The primary purpose of this conference is philosophical and motivational. Philosophical and motivational. You've had the motivational from Dr. Grant. I'm here to be more philosophical. According to the conference brochure, my job as a workshop speaker is to help you verify that your school is consistently classical and Christian in its philosophy and practice, to introduce some ways that your classes can be made more classical and Christian, and to motivate and encourage you to make the changes you might want to make as a result, and help you to see some ways to do that. Now, some of you are new to classical education. Others of you have been around classical circles for quite a while. I am the one who, over the years, has taken all the conference evaluation forms that people have filled out and summarized them for ACCS. It's just one of those detail things. I'm that kind of guy. And I have continually seen contradictory comments at the end. You have this comment of, come on, I've gone here year after year. I've heard all this before. When are you going to say something new? And, whoa, what's all this trivia stuff? How come nobody defined anything for me? I don't understand this. I'm confused. And, you know, and what do you do when you have a room full of people who are coming from different places in different directions? Well, that's a problem that every speaker has to deal with. Especially when you're speaking about something specifically as teaching mathematics classically. And so, because this is the first round of talks, I'm going to keep it introductory. If you've been here, if you know what the trivium is, if you understand Paul Perret-Pert Poetic, and if you know how to push that into the math class, you know, go hear Doug Wilson speak or something. That's what I'm going to talk about this hour. Okay, so teaching mathematics classically. Though this conference is on classical and Christian education, I'm going to concentrate this hour on the classical aspect of teaching math rather than the Christian aspect of teaching math. I am giving another talk on mathematics. There I will focus more on the Christian aspect of it. And I'm going to be talking about all levels of teaching, not just the secondary. A presentation on classical mathematics could focus on many different parts of teaching math. I could talk about the value of teaching mathematical history alongside of problem-solving techniques and how a historical analysis shows the importance of having a proper worldview in order for a culture to advance mathematically. And I've done that in previous conferences. I could talk about the importance of maintaining both rigor and delight in the class and how those two goals are the goals that we want in our classroom. I could talk about how a good math teacher will regularly emphasize both the beauty and the applicability of mathematics as a standard for truth. But I've chosen instead to concentrate on the basic structure of classical education curriculum, the structure that was used throughout the Middle Ages, the curriculum structure that's largely been maintained in the teaching of mathematics until very recently, and that is the trivium. I'm going to talk about the trivium as we understand it at Logos School, as ACCS presents it, and as it's presented by Dorothy Sayers in her essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. Is there anybody in here who hasn't read The Lost Tools of Learning? Raise your hand. Okay, see, there's all the rest of you. There's people that raised their hand. Okay, so that's why I want to talk about it. I'm going to start by describing the trivium approach to mathematics in general. The stated goal of a classical education is to teach students how to think, how to learn on their own. In The Lost Tools of Learning, Dorothy Sayers wrote, "For the sole true end of education is simply this, to teach men how to learn for themselves, and whatever instruction fails to do this is effort spent in vain." Other writers on classical education, such as Mortimer Adler and Douglas Wilson, have said the same thing. Their primary message has been this: the problem with modern education is that it concentrates too much on teaching subjects, specific subjects, rather than giving students the tools of learning by which they may learn any subject on their own. Our goal as classical Christian educators is to give our students tools of learning so that they're more able to love God with all of their mind and to push it down into the details. We want to teach students how to think properly according to their frame. And we want to imitate God in this, how He, as a Father, considers our frame. Psalm 103, 13 through 14 says, Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him, for he knoweth our frame. One of the strengths of classical education is that it seeks to understand the frame of the child at different stages in his educational career and to teach according to that frame. What do children at different stages in life enjoy? What are their strengths at different stages? Let's consider some. In my own experience, both from my own childhood and now as a father of four, children in the elementary years like to know the names of things. They like to be able to identify things by name. My fifth grade son, Jonathan, knows the names of all the different kinds of trees in our town, and he thinks it's funny that I don't know the names of all the trees in our town. You know, that's a tree, I say. And he says, that's a maple. Oh, that's another tree over there. When my other son, Josiah, was younger, he delighted in memorizing and being able to recite facts about the solar system. You know, Dad, what are the moons of Jupiter? You know, and this sort of thing. Dad, which asteroid is the one that has its own little moon going around it, and all this kind of stuff. He knew it all and loved it. He loved being able to name things like that. Elementary children like to sing and chant and can learn by heart amazing amounts of material in this way. My children all know their Latin chants. It's very easy to get them started on their Latin chants. All I have to do is bom bas bot, and bombus botus bont comes popping out, and then they start, you know, chanting away down the hall. They know the bones in the body, they know their presidents, they know the books of the Bible, they know the grammar of English sentences, and they know much more because they learned it all that way. Elementary children like to collect and sort things. Sayers says that they enjoy the mere accumulation of things. My daughter Jacqueline is the prime example of this. She has collected rocks, shells, coins, animal figurines, and even plastic communion cups. Especially during the summer, she will bring out all her shells or bring out all her coins and sort them according to size or color or her favorites. She's made the display boxes. She continually rearranges her figurines around her bedroom. And as of the writing of this talk, she informed me that she has exactly 1,648 communion cups. I don't know what... I keep asking, what are you going to do with them? You know, it's boxes. And she said, I don't know, I just like them, they're cute. Children in junior high like to question and argue. Not meaning that they like to talk to get their own way, although that's usually true. But they like to be able to give reasons for what they believe. Just learning something by heart no longer satisfies at this stage. During our family worship time, my son Josiah often plies me with questions. Questions about God's sovereignty and man's freedom. About God's justice. How can God condemn people to hell? How can we know that what we believe is true when other people believe something else? And he's very insistent in wanting to know the answers. He's questioning and arguing and ready to try to work through those sort of things. Junior high people like to catch others in their mistakes, especially adults, especially teachers and fathers. I'm all three of those, and my son reminds me. They further develop in their abstract thinking abilities, and they enjoy it. My daughter Jacqueline learned how to diagram sentences this last year. She thought it was funny that I didn't know how to diagram sentences. I told her I'd never diagrammed a sentence in my life. And so she went and wrote me a book of how to diagram sentences and gave it to me for Father's Day. Thanks, honey. When Josiah was in eighth grade, he read and reread The Fallacy Detective by Hans and Nathaniel Bluedorn. He loves those books. And I remember myself enjoying and anticipating proofs in geometry. I remember being in algebra in eighth grade saying, I can't wait to get to geometry so I can do proofs. High school students have their own set of idiosyncrasies. They yearn to express themselves in creative ways. They want to get more expressive. They want to get more poetic. My daughter Jamie, who just graduated, has by her own admission started 10 books, though she has finished none of them. I once had two students write alternate lines of poetry. One would write a line of poetry, hand it to the other student. He would write a line, hand it back. He would write a line, probably during my calculus class, although I had no idea when they wrote it. I only found out when I started discovering poems hidden in different nooks and crannies around my classroom. And they just did this spontaneously. No one was requiring it of them. It took me years to find all of them. I think I have them all now. High school students yearn to achieve independence. They begin to focus on one area of interest over others as they realize their particular strengths and desires. Now, Dorothy Sayers recognizes these tendencies in children and suggested that the best method of education would be to line up the first three of the seven liberal arts taught in the medieval schools, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, with these stages of child development, which she called the Paul Parrot, the Pert, and the Poetic. Grammar lined up with the Paul Parrot stage, basically upper elementary, logic with the PERT stage, junior high, and rhetoric with the poetic stage. Go ahead and put that first slide on. Sayers defined the liberal arts of grammar, logic, and rhetoric in this way. Grammar, she defined as learning a language, not just how to order a meal in a foreign language, but the structure of a language, and hence of language itself, what it was, how it was put together, and how it worked. Logic, or dialectic, she defined as learning how to use language, how to bring it all together, how to define terms and make accurate statements, how to construct an argument, and how to detect fallacies in argument. Rhetoric was defined as learning to express oneself in language, how to say what one has to say elegantly and persuasively. Now, we believe, is a good model for education. It's one that we stick to and use. It's one that we don't plan on changing. It's old news, but it's good news. There are other metaphors that can help to understand this process of the liberal arts. There's the computer metaphor of input, processing, output. The grammar stage is the input. They learn a lot of knowledge. Processing is the dialectic stage. They learn how to fit it all together, and the output. They want to express themselves. Or the Proverbs metaphor, knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. In the elementary years, they're gaining lots of knowledge. Students know things. And then in the dialectic years, they're gaining understanding. They're building on that knowledge and bringing that knowledge together in new and different ways. And then in the high school years, the poetic years, are the years of wisdom, where they're able to apply their knowledge and their understanding in new ways. Now, before we look in detail at how this fits with the mathematics curriculum, I want to introduce one more concept that will fit in with this, and that's the concept of mathematical abstraction. Mathematics is necessarily abstract as opposed to concrete, and it's abstract at all levels. It's not the students suddenly learn how to reason abstractly in the junior high years. I think that's a misunderstanding. There are different levels along that concrete abstract continuum. At the concrete level, we have physical things: apples, eggs, horses, blocks, oranges. At the first level of abstraction, we have numbers. Numbers represent quantities of objects. 5 apples, 5 blocks. That first level of abstraction, we have the idea of the pure number. When a child can think of the number 5, apart from 5 apples, when he can add 5 plus 5 equals 10 and not have to think of objects in his head to do it, he's at that first level of abstraction, when numbers make sense apart from the number of things. The second level of abstraction, we have variables, which are letters which represent numbers. X equals 5. When a child is able to manipulate variables without having to think what numbers they represent, like when he factors a polynomial, he's grasping that second level of abstraction. So when he learns to factor x squared minus y squared into x plus y times x minus y, and he doesn't have to think, okay, that means 5 squared minus 3 squared is 5 plus 3 times 5 minus 3, and he doesn't have to think that way, but he understands that he can factor it, then he's grasping that second level of abstraction at the dialectic stage. At the highest level of abstraction, we now have letters or symbols that represent complex mathematical operations, such as functions and operations of those functions, like derivatives and integrals, trig functions, polynomial functions, logarithmic functions. All of this is that higher level of abstraction. We now have a function of variables that represent numbers that represent a number of things, and we're deep in the abstraction level. It's very hard to make f of x equals 3x squared plus the natural log of the absolute value of sine of x concrete in any way, and yet that's the sort of function that our calculus students deal with all the time. And that's okay. Math is by nature abstract, but there are different levels of abstraction. The three liberal arts, the three stages of child development, and these three levels of mathematical abstraction all line up well with the traditional approach to mathematics. And I'm calling it the traditional approach to mathematics. Grammar stage mathematics, go ahead and uncover all of them. Grammar stage mathematics, third through sixth grade, includes primarily arithmetic. Arithmetic is working with numbers, that first level of abstraction. Arithmetic lends itself to memorization, which is the Paul Parrott stage tool, their primary tool. Students memorize multiplication tables. They memorize the decimal value of pi, approximation of it, or decimal equivalents of common fractions, 3/8 and 1/4 and 1/8 and 2/5 and so on. They're able to identify things by name. Hexagons, right triangles, trapezoids. Anything that can be memorized should be memorized, and so that these memorized facts and procedures, those are the two things we memorize, facts and procedures, can be easily and automatically recalled by the students for use in the next stages and for the rest of their lives. Sears writes, anything and everything which can be usefully committed to memory should be memorized at this period, whether it is immediately intelligible or not. The modern tendency is to try and force rational explanations on a child's mind at too early an age. Intelligent questions, spontaneously asked, should, of course, receive an immediate and rational answer. But it is a great mistake to suppose that a child cannot readily enjoy and remember things that are beyond his power to analyze. It's perfectly acceptable for a student to learn, for example, how to do long division, to how to run through that long division rubric, without being able to explain why it works. Could you explain why the long division rubric works? It's not easy. You know, it takes some thought to figure out. But you can all do it. You all do it because you learned how to do it automatically. And that's okay. It's okay that our students who are able to do long division can't explain why the long division procedure works. Put that number to that number. You know, how many times does it go in? Subtract. Bring the next number down. Put that one to that one. You know, why? Why do we do that? Well, it works. Now, you can prove why it works. And if a student asks, why does this work? Some precocious fifth grader asks, why does this work? You should be able to explain it. But you shouldn't have to force that explanation on them so that they can all answer it back. It's okay. An arithmetic problem, the students should learn that the problems also have a single correct answer and a best way to solve them. Problems at this stage have a single correct answer and a best way to solve them. An arithmetic problem with a correct answer, such as 1/8 equals 0.125, is true. And when shown this, a good student will typically respond, I know that. I know that 1/8 is 0.125. It's true. It has that response from a good student. Now, this is not the time to require students to develop their own methods or to justify existing methods, though, of course, questions about such things should receive answers. Logic stage mathematics, 7th through 9th grade, junior high, naturally includes algebra and geometry. Algebra works with variables, that second level of abstraction. Algebra and geometry both use deductive logic, which is the primary PERT stage tool of learning. They derive identities in algebra, they write formal proofs in geometry. The students here should learn that there are many ways to solve these problems. There's not one way, like there was in arithmetic, one best way. There's lots of different ways to solve these problems, many of which could be correct. You could write a proof in more than one way. Some proofs are more elegant than others, and we introduced that idea of logical elegance. Now, this one's shorter, this one's simpler, it's a more beautiful approach. That's a new idea to the dialectic student. The student should learn that through the creative use of rules, time, and hard work, almost any valid proof can be solved, at least in theory. This stage is the appropriate time for debates about mathematics. Does 0.9 bar equal 1 exactly? That's a good debate for students to work through. And it's easy to find students that will fall on one side or the other. Do numbers exist? What does that even mean? Do circles exist? Is there a circle anywhere? Now that gets into the whole idea of like platonic forms and things. Is space infinitely divisible? Now, how many positions in moving from there to there does my hand pass through? It's a finite number, it's an infinite number, one of the two. Both of them seem to cause me mental problems. Because it's hard to answer. But it's good for students at this stage to work through those sort of abstract thoughts. This is a time for having students read and critique essays about mathematics. A couple good examples. I have my students read J.B.S. Haldane's On Being the Right Size. I remember my teacher having me read On Being the Right Size. How many of you have read On Being the Right Size? Anybody in here? No? This is a great essay. It's really, he talks about the impossibility of giants and the impossibility of things of some size shrinking down. Why our structures wouldn't work. His basic thesis is that for every the way something works, it has its own right size. You couldn't make a man 10 times bigger than he is. He wouldn't work. King Kong would break his bones every time he took a step. You know, that sort of thing. It's a fascinating essay. J.B.S. Haldane on being the right size. It's online. Haldane is H-A-L-D-A-N-E. J.B.S. Haldane on being the right size. There's a good book by Morris Klein, K-L-I-N-E, Morris Klein, called Mathematics and the Search for Knowledge. Klein has written lots of books on mathematics. But this one, Mathematics and the Search for Knowledge, has a chapter in it called Is There an External World? And that's a fascinating one that I've had my students read as well. How do we know that there is an external world, and how do we analyze it through mathematics? A typical logic stage problem with a correct answer, such as a geometry proof, is valid. Arithmetic problems and answers were true. Now, at this stage, the problems and the answers, the typical ones, are valid. A good student here will typically respond, I understand this. I can follow that. Rather than, I know it, it's now, I understand it. I can follow that. Rhetoric stage mathematics, 9th through 12th grade, high school, properly includes analytical geometry, trigonometry, and calculus, in that order. These subjects cover functions and their operations, which is that third level of abstraction, and they combine and they synthesize previous learning in new ways. Algebra and geometry are combined into analytical geometry. Analytical geometry takes the equations of algebra and shows how they can be used to form and analyze the shapes of geometry. And it does so, as we all know, using the Cartesian coordinate system named after René Descartes. Before Descartes, it would have been meaningless to say y equals mx plus b is the equation of a line. Before Descartes, they would have said, wait, y equals mxb is a thing of algebra. A line is a thing of geometry. But Descartes and Fermat and others brought those together in the new science of analytical geometry. That helps to explain why the proper order for mathematics is algebra, geometry, advanced algebra. People have asked, why do you put geometry in the middle of there? Why not algebra, advanced algebra? Because advanced algebra is geometry and algebra being brought together in a new science, and it's good to have both those backgrounds before you introduce it. Now, this agrees also with what Dorothy Sayers says about the rhetoric stage, where, quote, the things once coldly analyzed, algebra and geometry, can now be brought together to form a new synthesis, she says. When presented with a problem and its answer at this stage, such as using an integral in calculus to show that the area under half a period of the sine x curve is exactly 2, the student should say, wow, that's cool, that's powerful. How is it that you can, that thing can show that? Now that's the sort of response here. Not, it's true, I know that, or, that's valid, I understand that, but wow, that's powerful. Now these problems are also true and they're also valid, but there's something more that comes out of students that really understand it at this stage. There should be excitement. This is the appropriate time for student self-discovery, for students working together to develop solution strategies. This is the appropriate time for the teacher primarily working as a facilitator. This is the appropriate time for students doing independent research in mathematics, allowing them to discover, expand, or explain something by their own unaided research. Also, we would at this stage allow students with different aptitudes in mathematics to take different classes. I would allow calculus to be an elective, for example. And Sayers said the same thing. Those who are likely never to have any great use or aptitude for mathematics might also be allowed to rest more or less upon their oars. That's okay. Both I and many of my students are very thankful that calculus is not required in their senior year, because they just don't want to be there. And if they don't want to be there, that's fine by me. Even though I love them all, and I would, you know, It's a dilemma I run into every year. I tell my juniors, I'd love to have you all in calculus, but I also want a small class. And I can't have both. So those that want to be there are there. Okay, my main point here is that the trivium model should affect how we teach math. It should affect how we teach math. It's an appropriate method, an appropriate curriculum approach to teaching mathematics. Now, let's push that into some details here. The selection of math teachers and teaching styles. Teachers at every level of the trivium are going to share much in common. They all need to know and love their subjects, They all need to know and love their students. They will all need to know the material that they teach very well, better than their best students, so that they, and not the textbook, are driving the lesson. They need to be able to see math in the world around them so that they can use that for explanations and examples in class. Remember one time I was teaching a particular calculus lesson about a constantly changing area, and I was taking a walk at lunchtime just before calculus, and there's this church that has a steeple that goes whoop like that. And I was looking at it, and if you do a cross section of it, it's a square, but it comes up like a logarithmic curve. And I said, we can find the volume of that thing. So I'm sitting there, standing there trying to figure out roughly how big it is so that I can go back and use that as an example in my class when we're teaching that particular lesson. You need to be able to see things like that as a good math teacher at all levels. The teacher will need to take time to study and review his material before he teaches it, especially at the upper level math classes. It's good to regularly, in calculus, I do every test and every quiz before I give it to my students. I'm writing the answer key, that's why. I don't use tests that the textbooks give me. I just write my own. And I often do the assignments beforehand as well, just to keep fresh, keep it all fresh in my mind. So you need to love your subject, you need to be excited about what you teach, you need to love your students and be excited about teaching them. Good teaching, in fact, means loving your subject in the presence of students who are learning to love it. Good teaching is loving your subject in the presence of students who are learning to love it. And of course, good teachers need to be godly, patient people, growing in the fruit of the Spirit and the love of the Lord. That's a given. But specifically, teachers should understand how students at their level of the trivium that they're teaching at think and learn, and what kind of explanations and teaching styles are appropriate to that stage. At the grammar stage, the math teacher should be the kind of teacher who can work well with a class full of little children, playing games, making displays, doing hands-on activities, all those things that terrify me, which makes me a secondary teacher. They need to be able to teach a large number of math facts, keeping in mind that these facts are being stored away for use in the later stages. They need to use lots of hands-on examples. They need to be able to show three groups of five pencils as a way of explaining that 3 times 5 is 15 and so on. And to use creative methods of memorizing all the things they need to memorize at that stage. Chants and practice sheets and so on. All those things that elementary teachers need to do. At the logic stage, the math teacher should be familiar with the tools of the grammar stage. We don't lose those previous tools. We keep using them all the way up and use them at the logic stage when appropriate. They need to be familiar with the concepts and basic tools of deductive logic. If you're teaching at the junior high stage, you should learn logic. You need to be able to use language that your students who are taking logic understand and are familiar with. You should be excited about proofs, excited about derivations. You should be skilled at writing them so that a student who writes a correct proof that's different than the one in the answer key gets praised rather than rebuked. Yeah, that's a good way to do it. It's different than what's in the answer key. Well done. You need to be the kind of teacher who isn't frightened by students who show off their knowledge or who like to challenge your views. So if you claim that the area of a circle is pi r squared, and then Kellen Meyer says, Mr. Nance, how do we know the area of a circle is pi r squared? You can respond, that's a great question. Let's find out. Okay? We should take advantage of students' tendencies at this stage rather than squelch them. The logic stage teacher should be reading books about math so that he can lead his students in readings which may be helpful for them and interesting for them. You should be able to run a class debate so that you can keep everybody involved in learning in a way that they enjoy. Most lessons at the dialectic stage, at the logic stage, should use Socratic discussion, with the teacher asking questions of the students, leading them in discussion to deduce a particular conclusion, namely the point of the lesson, that conclusion that you have in mind. You know where you want to lead them. Figure out those questions that you need to ask and run that discussion to lead them to that same conclusion. So, for example, you want to teach that the area of a circle is pi r squared. Start with the question, what's the area of a circle? Some smart kid in class will say, pi r squared. And so you say, okay, what does that mean? What does area mean? When you say the area of a circle is 5. What do you mean by that? Well, you mean, really, that it has the same area as the square that has area 5. The square to 5 times square to 5 on the different sides. What does pi mean? Well, pi means the circumference divided by the diameter, which they would have learned in elementary school, which is the circumference divided by twice the radius. Okay? And so you ask that question, what does pi mean? Some student will know the answer to that. Circumference divided by twice the radius. So, well, given that, you say, let's rewrite pi r squared. If pi is circumference over twice the radius times r squared, then the area of a circle is really the circumference times the radius divided by 2. Now, can you show a rectangle that has a circumference times the radius divided by 2? Well, so you have them draw something like that. And then you say, okay, let's take a circle with pi segments like that and let's open it up. In fact, if you can take an orange and slice it down the great circle of the orange and cut it and then open it up, you'll get that sort of shape if you do it well and the orange peels nicely. And say, okay, well now we have the circumference, you know, all that, you know, circumference of the orange is now on that bottom line, and the middle parts of the orange are all the radius, the radii. Now, can I turn something like that into the circumference divided by 2 times the radius? Now, a smart student will say, well, if you take the circumference divided by 2 and just flip that over onto that part, you get that rectangular-looking thing down there. That's the circumference divided by 2 times the radius. So yes, that's pi r squared. That's what we showed earlier, is that pi r squared is the circumference times the radius over 2. And so you know where you want to go, and you come up with some creative way of getting there that the students are able to understand. And they would think that something kind of abstract, like pi r squared, actually gets pretty concrete. And that's good teaching. Teach with the Socratic method, but know where you want to go. At the rhetoric stage, the math teacher should be familiar with the tools of learning from the grammar and the logic stages to use them when appropriate. For example, I still use grammar stage techniques in teaching calculus. I have my derivative of trig functions chant. The derivative of the sine is cosine. The derivative of cosine is negative sine. The derivative of the tangent is secant squared. The derivative of the secant is tangent secant. And dun da dun da dun da dun da dun. We have this neat little chant that we run through. I don't sing it to anything, but it's still a chant. I have the product rule. When you're taking the derivative of a product of functions, the derivative is 1d2 plus 2d1. The derivative of the quotient is low d high minus high d low over the square of what's below. And the students think it's funny, but they remember it. And I use those sort of methods because these are grammatical tools. I want the students to be able to instantly recall them. Now, I teach them. They understand the rules. It's not just that I teach them the rule and leave it there. They understand where these rules come from. They're not hard to derive. But then we memorize them so that they can recall them instantly and use them automatically. When introducing a completely new concept, the teacher should follow the typical logic stage approach. It's a completely new concept. You should use some sort of Socratic discussion to teach that new concept, and maybe even some basic grammar stuff. You know, here's the name of this thing. But the rhetoric stage math teacher should primarily be a facilitator who understands his material so well that he can let students work in groups to develop their own problem-solving techniques. And this is where it gets more difficult. So I'm going to outline the approach to a lesson that basically builds on previous lessons. So I'm assuming that some lesson that builds on stuff they've previously learned is not completely new. I start by writing a problem on the whiteboard, which the students have not learned how to solve, but that they'll know how to solve when they learn the method for the day. So I start with some problem that they can't yet solve, but that they're going to learn how to solve with that method. I make sure that they understand exactly what I'm asking. Yeah, so I've taught derivatives, say, of polynomial functions or integrals of polynomial functions. Now let's try, well, what's the derivative of sine? Well, that's, you know, they've not seen a derivative of a trig function before. They know that a derivative is a slope and so on, but they've not, you know, this is a new idea, but it's built on all previous ideas. They know what a derivative is. They know what a sine function is. Those are all familiar ideas. It's just I'm bringing things together in a new way. So I say, okay, what's the derivative of the sine of x? And they won't know. Okay? I say, good. Well, let's see if we can find out. You know what it means. I'm asking, what's the slope of the sine function at any given point? Okay. See if you can come up with some way on your own, at your desk, or at your table, come up with some way of figuring out what the derivative is. Don't look in your textbook. And I let them think through it. Now, occasionally, a smart student will figure it out. And he'll say, I got it. And you say, okay, you check his work. Good, now go ahead and explain to the class what you did, how you got it. And have him teach the lesson. And then we're done. Okay, and then I push it into further details. But if you don't have any one student that comes up with the answer, then put the students together in small groups and give them a little while, 5, 10, 15 minutes, to work together to come up with some method of solving it. And then walk around from group to group, give hints, give suggestions, give encouragements, be a coach, and help them, move them in that right direction. Don't tell them the final answer. That will snatch away joy that they should get on their own. Let the students struggle with the problem. Don't think of struggle as a bad thing. Struggle is a good thing. When you're exercising, you're struggling. And when it really hurts, that's when it's good. That's when you're building muscles. When a student asks you a question, try to answer with another question. Try to get them thinking. Don't let them give up too quickly. Tell them, keep thinking. The solution is right there within your grasp if you just think of this one more thing. Now, once the groups have begun to solve the problem correctly with their own methods, then I get the students to share and compare. Share and compare. Have them go up to the board, if you have enough whiteboard space, have different students go up to different places and write up what they did and then have them talk about what they did, especially if they did it differently. And then end the lesson by summarizing what we've learned and giving them problems to work on. That's my typical approach in a typical day of calculus. Upper stage math. Now, notice what that kind of lesson accomplishes. The students are doing the mathematical thinking, struggling, and discovering on their own. They are learning how to learn. And that's what the classical approach to education means. Learning how to learn on their own, independently of a teacher. And they're also learning how to express themselves. When you have a student who's teaching the class, or you have students showing what they've done, they're learning how to express themselves, which is the other aspect of classical education. Synthesis, expression, learning how to learn. The trivium approach should also affect the selection of math textbooks. Now, I put this last, not because I think it's the most important, but because I honestly think it's the least important. The math textbook is the least important of the three things that the trivium approach will affect. A good teacher with a good teaching style will be able to teach well regardless of how good or bad their textbook is to a certain extent. The textbook is and should be the tool of the teacher, not the other way around. But there are good textbooks and there are bad textbooks and we should understand the difference between them. So, good textbooks at all levels, I think, would include the following things. They should be traditional in appearance. Attractive, but not too flashy, not distracting. They should be written in clear, engaging English that the students can understand and learn on their own from. They should be arranged in a logical progression of lessons, which build upon each other in a cohesive way. Logical progression, which build upon each other in a cohesive way. Mathematics is, by and large, cumulative and cohesive. It builds on itself and it all fits together. And the textbook should reflect that. Clear explanations with plenty of helpful examples in the lessons should be included. Clear explanations, lots of helpful examples. Some historical information on the development of mathematics or with brief histories of mathematicians are good to include as well. And if your textbook doesn't have them, you should include them. There should be lots of practice exercises. There should be review problems. There should be problems that are progressively unlike the examples, though logically following from the techniques that are used to solve the examples. They should be different from the examples, but they should they should be solvable using the same techniques. A good text will include some really challenging problems. Some really challenging problems. And, of course, they should include some application problems, some word or story problems, and more as they get into the higher levels. A good text also should include some, but not all of the answers in the back of the book. The answers to the odd problems, for example, is something typical. And that gives the teacher the option of which problems to assign for different reasons. I generally assign the even problems, the ones that do not have the answer in the back of the book, and I save the odd problems for students to review on their own. Then they have the problems and the answers there, and when they're reviewing for a test or a quiz, they can use those. If I'm gone that day and I have a substitute, I assign odd problems. It's just convenient that way. It's nice. So a good textbook will include that. For the logic stage, a good textbook will include clear derivations of problem-solving techniques so that the students can see not only that they work, but why they work, how they work. The teacher should lead the student through derivations and proofs at this stage, be excited about derivations and proofs at this stage, as a way of further developing their reasoning skills. That's the main thing we're doing at the dialectic stage, is developing reasoning skills, developing logic skills. There should be a dedicated textbook to the class that gives the classical approach to teaching geometry. They should include compass and straight edge constructions. They should include standard Euclidean style proofs to solve, starting with axioms and definitions and postulates and theorems, as a great example and practice with deductive reasoning. That's the thing that's the main tool the students are learning at this stage. There should be formulas for finding the properties of two and three dimensional figures. Of course, that's what geometry is all about. Let me give a brief comparison of some geometry text, and that will hopefully eliminate some of these things. For geometry, I like two different texts. I've used and like two different texts. I like Harold Jacobs. I like Scott Forsman. And I like them for completely different reasons. I wish I could combine them. I like Harold Jacobs because it's very traditional in approach. It is not overly flashy or colorful or distracting. It has good review, good application of material learned in logic. And that's good to see. I must admit, I like how he uses Peanuts and VC and other comics to illustrate what the lesson's about. It just makes it fun. I like Scott Forsman, UCSMP, the University of Chicago School of Mathematics Project, for geometry, because it also teaches explicit applications of logic. It also shows how to derive theorems from reflections. And that's a fascinating use of abstracting methods from the physical world that the students can understand. When I ran into that, that just really intrigued me. I liked it. I like the fact that lessons typically start with an example, some real-world example. They abstract a process to solving problem, and then they make the students apply that to a very different kind of problem. That's a good technique for learning. That's how learning happens at this stage. It can be occasionally politically correct. It can be occasionally distracting in its colorful pictures and so on, and I just ignore them. That's okay. Now, you noticed that I did not mention Saxon. That's because Saxon doesn't teach geometry. To be sure, geometry is scattered throughout Saxon's other textbooks, but that scattered approach, what they call the distributed or the incremental approach, I think fails to show geometry as a logical, cohesive art. Geometry is a logical, cohesive art, and Saxon doesn't show that. Saxon's method of teaching proofs, I think, is appalling. A lesson that shows a proof and then makes the students do exactly that same proof and then exactly that same proof three lessons later and gives them enough proofs so that the good students can figure out how to really do proofs and gives them enough so that they can do well on standardized tests. That's okay, but it doesn't teach students the deductive method. It doesn't teach students that geometry is an art, that you can start with a few basic assumptions. This idea needs to come into the mind of the students. I can start with a few basic assumptions, and through pure deductive reasoning, I can prove all of these things. I can solve anything if I have the time and the creativity. Okay. Saxon doesn't teach that. I'm sorry. The medium is the message, and Saxon fails to show geometry as a logical art because of this medium that it uses. Now, Saxon is fine for the grammar stage. I like it for the grammar stage. I like the traditional style. I like the continual review. We use it throughout our elementary, though our teachers sometimes complain that it's a bit slow and repetitive for the students. We do supplement quite a bit. We've written some of our own material for the early elementary that we call classical math, that's sold at probably Logos School Materials. But I don't like it for geometry. For the rhetoric stage, I don't have much more to say about textbooks. Rhetoric stage math texts, I think, should include exercises which have students write about mathematics, write about methods and concepts. They should offer projects for further study, which can extend the concepts in new ways that can facilitate independent research on the part of the students. But there's a good rhetoric stage textbook is typically a college-level textbook, at least in calculus. So at Logos School, we use, for 10th grade, we use Scott Forsman again, Advanced Algebra. 11th grade, we use Houghton Mifflin's Precalculus and Trigonometry. And for 12th grade, we use Houghton Mifflin Calculus. And I like their calculus text. There's some things I wish it had that it doesn't have. I wish it had more review than it has, more planned review. But yeah, I can supplement again. Okay. Given all this, my point here is that we need to resist the modern trend away from the trivium approach, away from the traditional approach to mathematics. And that modern trend is happening in two different directions at the same time. First, we make the mistake of using only the methods of the grammar stage to teach math up into the junior high and high school levels. And I think that's an error. It's right and good to use grammar stage methods to teach grammar stage students and grammar stage facts. Having them memorize lots of basic facts for instant recall, practicing specific problem-solving techniques, using constant repetition to make those skills automatic, giving them a problem to solve with one technique that provides one correct answer, using that same technique on the next problem, all of that is good. That's great stuff, but not for teaching geometry, not for teaching advanced algebra, trigonometry, and calculus. Now, I think that's Saxon's primary mistake in upper-level math. I think it artificially extends the methods of the grammar stage into the logic and rhetoric stages. Saxon math, with its constant repetition and large number of homework problems every day, train students to look for the trick. What's the trick to solving this particular problem? Don't talk to me, spend all that time on understanding it, Mr. Nance. I want to know the trick to tackle that type of problem. Rather than giving them tools of learning that can solve any kind of problem, that's what we're aiming at. I think Saxon math trains students so that they can do well on standardized tests, which is Saxon's stated goal, but it doesn't teach students how to learn math on their own. Secondary students should struggle through math. They should be bewildered with problems they've never seen before, rather than problems that they saw worked out on the previous page. They should have to think through them and discover with joy that they can indeed take the fundamental concepts and solve the problem on their own. Saxon too often removes the thrill of discovery and replaces it with the satisfaction of getting the homework done and getting the problems right. Now, the satisfaction of getting the homework done and getting the problems right is great for the grammar stage. I got it all done and I got them all right. Yay! Okay? But that's not enough for the dialectic and the rhetoric stages. They need more. Secondly, we need to avoid the opposite mistake of forcing the logic and rhetoric stage math down into the lower years. And let me give you an example of that. Since we are in Atlanta, I'm going to just stick my neck out even farther than I already have and quote the Georgia Mathematics Performance Standards. Okay, here's where I get in trouble by someone. They say this. At all grades, the curriculum encourages students, notice at all grades, the curriculum encourages students to reason mathematically, to evaluate mathematical arguments, both formally and informally, to use the language of mathematics to communicate ideas and information precisely, and to make connections among mathematical topics and other disciplines. Now, students in the logic stage would enjoy reasoning mathematically. They would be good at evaluating arguments formally and informally. I can hardly imagine a better description of logic stage mathematics. That's great. I couldn't have written it better. Students at the rhetoric stage would benefit from teachers encouraging them to use the language of mathematics to communicate ideas precisely, to make connections among mathematical topics and other disciplines. It sounds like these people are quoting Sayers. This is a great description of rhetoric stage math. But this is not the best approach to third and fourth grade math. If math at the third and fourth grades were taught consistently with these standards, most younger students would find it overly difficult, unpleasant, tedious. Teachers would either have to ignore the standard, or they would have to force it down into that level where it does not naturally belong. Now, the standards produced by the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, I just might as well get in trouble with the whole nation now, I think make the same mistake. Now, let me identify just two improper, what I believe are improper emphases of NCTM because of their failure to recognize the trivium approach to math. Okay? The use of calculators to the disparagement of memorization and mastering procedures. Okay, this is an emphasis. I understand I'm brushing with, I'm painting with a broad brush here. But this is what they say. When calculators can do multi-digit long division in a microsecond, serious questions arise about what is important in the mathematics curriculum and what it means to learn mathematics. More than ever, mathematics must include the mastery of concepts instead of mere memorization and the following of procedures. School mathematics must include an understanding of how to use technology to arrive meaningfully at solutions to problems instead of endless attention to increasingly outdated computational tedium. Okay? Now, you see what the... I know that there would be exceptions. I understand all that. But their emphasis is one that I think is attacking an approach that's and promoting something that I don't think should be promoted here. They also have an emphasis on student-created methods and a de-emphasis on standard algorithms. An emphasis on student-created methods. They say, I think I have this quote. Many students are likely to develop and use methods. Yeah. Many students are likely to develop and use methods that are not the same as the conventional algorithms. The conventional algorithms for multiplication and division should be investigated in grades 3 through 5 as one efficient way to calculate. I don't think so. I think the students ought to be taught the proper approaches and said and be told, this is how you should do this problem. This is the best way to multiply. This is the best way to divide. Now, if a student says, is there another way to multiply? You should say, sure, let's look at it and be excited about it. But it's not going to be as good as the standard way that we've learned over history to be the best way to multiply and divide. Now, Bill Quirk, in his Understanding the Revised NCTM Standards, writes this. The NCTM says they want to maximize understanding, but they still fail to recognize that specific math content must first be stored in the brain as a necessary precondition for understanding to occur. Although rarely the preferred method, intentional memorization is sometimes the most efficient approach. The first objective is to get it into the brain. Then newly remembered math knowledge can be connected to previous remembered math knowledge, and understanding becomes possible. See that? Knowledge building to understanding. That's the trivium approach to mathematics. You have to know math before you can understand math, do math, or solve math problems. Okay. With the trivium, my point here is that with the trivium, we have an approach that works with math. And we need to be careful not to lose this approach because of modern forces pushing us in different directions. As I often tell my students when they come up during a test to ask me a question, don't talk yourself out of a right answer. So many times I see students doing it right, and they're saying, and they're asking me this question, I'm thinking, they're going to start doing it wrong. Don't talk yourself out of a right answer. It's sort of a hint of, it's a way of saying, you're doing it right, go back to your desk. But I have this, I want to give us the same message here. Let's not talk ourselves out of a right answer. Up until the last 100 years or so, the trivium had provided the proper approach to education. This understanding of grammar, logic, and rhetoric has influenced how schools teach mathematics up till this day. This understanding is being challenged by modern one-size-fits-all approaches to teaching math by people who fail to recognize that students learn in different ways at different stages in their education. We need to be aware of this and not let this proper and helpful approach to teaching mathematics be rejected, lost, or forgotten. Thank you.